Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, December 29th. As we prepare to usher in 2026, there is some apprehension about the New Year's Eve celebrations, given the death of six people from an explosion of illegal fireworks in an Oahu neighborhood. It was one of the worst cases ever in Hawaii's history, with mass casualties in a crowded neighborhood. What followed was a call for tougher laws and a crackdown on a growing problem. We hear from a lawmaker from the affected area about his concerns. Will someone be held accountable for those killed and maimed in the blast? We also learn more about property values along our coast, why research shows a beachfront property may not be the best investment. And we consider the announcement of a major deal taking the last of the Big Five companies private. We untangle the history of the Big Five from missionaries to modern-day landlords. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Honolulu Mayor Rick Mangiardi is holding a news conference later today to talk about what has changed a year after the fatal fireworks explosion that killed six people, including a three-year-old boy. Scores of innocent people were injured as a result of the blast in a Salt Lake Liumanu neighborhood. Close to two dozen were seriously burned, and six had to be flown to an Arizona burn center for treatment. Here on The Conversation last week, we heard from State Law Enforcement Director Mike Lambert, as well as Honolulu Deputy Fire Chief Jason Samala, and Dr. Jim Ireland, head of the city's Emergency Medical Services Department. This morning, we talked to a veteran lawmaker who represents the neighborhood where that fatal explosion took place. Senator Glenn Wakai chairs the Committee on Energy and the Intergovernmental Affairs for the Senate, and he expressed concerns that a year after the disaster, no one has been held accountable. He is hopeful for a calmer Eve celebration this week.
Yes, I'm sure that the devastation of a year ago has sunk into the neighborhood and throughout the state as to the real negative ramifications of fireworks. So we've seen and heard a quieter year in the past. You would hear sporadic fireworks, and from Thanksgiving till New Year's, you would hear it almost every night. But thank goodness this year is far different, far quieter. It's not silent, but it is far less booms in the evenings.
Well, you know, we did talk to Mike Lambert, director of law enforcement, and, you know, he talked about how they are, you know, really trying to be proactive. They have seized shipments at the ports, and people can, alert authorities where they are hearing fireworks go off in their neighborhood now in advance of the new year. I mean, it is illegal.
Yes. Yeah. And this past year, from a legislative standpoint, we really beefed up both the penalties for those who decide to pop illegals, as well as giving Mike Lambert the resources he needs. He now has drones at his disposal, can use that as evidence. We've upped the penalties for those who get into fireworks mischief. And we've also funded the beginnings of a fireworks laboratory to make sure that he can test the chemicals, use that as evidence, and prosecute all the scoundrels in our community.
Well, is it your hope, though, that people are going to heed the tougher talks and the tougher rules?
Oh, I'm sure that was a wake-up call last January, and that just the indication throughout, not just the Salt Lake community, but throughout many communities, I've heard many of my friends, as well as fellow lawmakers, say that it is much quieter these days. So I think people got the message. Unfortunately, it took six lives to really get that clearly across to people about the destruction fireworks can cause. But I'm very confident come January 1st or New Year's Eve that it will be a much calmer, quieter time. Not going to be silent night, but it will be a far less dangerous night.
I know that people are wondering about follow-up from that blast. The mayor is holding a news conference later today to address some of these issues, and I believe a representative from the prosecutor's office will be there. But what are your concerns at this point?
My concerns is that, you know, the community has been shaken to their core about the detrimental side of fireworks, but we really haven't seen consequences of that bad behavior. And I think that is also important, because we can make all the arrests we want, but unless people are actually, you know, charged and convicted of crimes, then it's all kind of make-believe for the public. So I think really at this point, it's up to law enforcement has the tools. It's up to the prosecutor to get the case ready and to take the case to trial and show the community that government is not fooling around anymore.
And I know that it's tough because they have, you know, yet to come out with anything as far as their probe and holding people accountable. But, you know, the fact that it's been a year and we've not seen anything.
Yes, that is concerning. There were supposedly almost 100 people out there on the street. There are a lot of witnesses. Whether they're reluctant witnesses, I'm not sure. But, I mean, there's a cache of fireworks in the guy's garage. How much more evidence do you need? I mean, it's all on display. It's not like a drug deal that went on in a dark alley and we have to get cameras and find drone footage of that. I mean, this was out there for dozens of people to witness. I'm not too sure why it's taken almost a year to even take this case to trial.
We hope to find out more later today. But what are your thoughts just on the enforcement side with the Honolulu patrol officers being out on the streets?
I think the public better be wary and beware that come New Year's Eve this year, that they might have gotten away with their rogue antics last year, but law enforcement is going to be out there to catch the bad actors out there, and there are going to be consequences in the future. Just the fact that you can use drone footage as evidence, I think, is going to be huge, because in the past, we relied on neighbors to rat out on neighbors, and we have a community that likes to grumble and gripe, but won't take the added step of actually ratting out their neighbors. So now we don't need to rely on that. We can actually have footage and evidence that can hold people accountable.
Yeah, and it was a tough scene to come across that evening, you know, for our first responders, just because of the chaos and so many casualties and fatalities. And your heart does go out to those families that lost multiple loved ones and the suffering that the injured had to endure, just because those burn injuries, you know, are pretty tough as far as, you know, recovery.
Yeah, I mean, fireworks in the Aliamanu case involved a lot of innocent victims. They were just watching. They weren't the ones actually lighting the fuse. And that's what's, not to say that it's better if the culprits get injured, but you have innocent bystanders, and it shows you the dangers of fireworks, that it's not just the perpetrator that potentially could have injury or property damage. It's those who are in the vicinity who are just innocently, maybe just at home and their house catches on fire because a rogue firecracker lands on their roof. Why should they have to suffer for the actions of a few? I think, yeah, we learned a lot from last year, and I am very confident that this year will be dramatically different.
Anything else you want to add or underscore to our listeners just as we prepare to ring in 2026?
No, I just think that come 2026, when we usher in the new year, that should be a day of celebration and joy and optimism. Last year, it was a moment of catastrophe and misery. We never want to revisit that moment.
Yeah, and I know driving by the neighborhood, I mean, it looks all cleaned up. It looks normal, but you just know that lots of people are hurting as a result, even just a year later.
Oh, yeah. That hurt will be there for their lifetime. I mean, what trauma that they saw and witnessed, and the loss of lives and the loss of their property, that will never be replaced.
All right. Senator Rakai, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Okay. Sure thing, Catherine. Happy holidays.
We've been hearing from Senator Glenn Mukai, who represents a district where an accidental explosion of illegal fireworks killed 6 people, including a 3-year-old child. The veteran lawmaker is hoping that the sobering tragedy in that Oahu neighborhood will have lasting impacts on those who may try and defy the law and detonate illegal aerials in our neighborhoods. We've also been hearing from you on social media. In response to our segment with Department of Law Enforcement Director Mike Lambert, Michelle writes, "Good luck enforcing this. I'll believe it when I see it." And Hero commented on Facebook, "In the shadow of the Aliamanu tragedy, I wonder how that would affect this year's celebration. I notice less out of the back of the car street sales happening, and even a retailer has decided not to participate this year." And Earl says it'll be interesting to see what kind of enforcement they have this year. Since they passed a new law in June and hired a new person to head the task force, the state claims that they will do a much better job of catching people who are in possession of legal fireworks. Drones will be deployed with specialized heat sensors that will videotape people in homes lighting up illegal fireworks. They will have a limited amount of drones, so I predict that they will make an example out of people using illegal fireworks and prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law to deter others the following year. We do appreciate your feedback. You can join the conversation by following Hawaii Public Radio on Facebook or Instagram, or call and leave a voicemail at 808-792-8217. We do plan to hear more from the mayor and his cabinet following the news conference later today.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
The world takes you around the globe, bringing you up close to major events.
Ambassador, thanks for being with us again. What's at the top of the agenda when Putin...
And introducing you to wonderfully strange characters.
And he was seen as this kind of musical oddball, even petting a pig so it got the right squeak.
Wait, what?
From the serious to the sublime, it's all part of the world. Listen weekdays.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. There are many well-known symbols for our state. Many associate us with the pineapple, or the palm tree, or the surfboard. For others, it is the ukulele, or the hula dancer, or the silhouette of Diamond Head. And just like there are symbols people associate with our state, there are also symbols that represent each of the eight major islands. For most, it's a flower, from bright blossoms like the ohialehua and the ilima, to the vine-like hinahina. For a couple of islands, the symbol is more unique. Ni'ihau is represented by the Ni'ihau shell, and Kauai by the Mokihana berry. There's another characteristic among the island symbols that makes it unique. It was introduced to Hawaii in the early 1800s. For today's backyard quiz, it's a two-parter. Which of the flowers that represent the Hawaiian Islands is the only non-native flower, and what island does it represent? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a pack of the card game Kumula'au and an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NereidHawaii.com.
city and county of Honolulu has mailed out annual property value assessments to more than 300,000 homeowners. The assessments determine next year's property taxes. The deadline to file an appeal is January 15th. But even as properties in areas like the North Shore grow in value, new research finds that the value of coastal properties is diminishing due to sea level rise. And what's even more interesting is that this effect is varied by island. Depreciation of coastal properties was most pronounced on Oahu and Hawaii Island, while the researchers found no significant price effect on Kauai. They think it may be due to the difference between Akamai local buyers and non-local buyers who might make an offer on a property without doing their due diligence. Nori Tarui is a University of Hawaii at Manoa economics professor. He conducted the research with Talal Khan, a finance graduate student at the Schuyler College of Business. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Tarui and Khan about the work. Tarui starts us off.
The motivation was that many people are now concerned about severe weather and major coastal disasters, including flooding, storm surge, and heavy rain, in addition to the threat of sea level rise and coastal erosion. So many people are concerned about the effects of such disasters on various coastal infrastructure and housing. So the first order thing that we wanted to look at is whether the threat of sea level rise is already affecting the current housing market. So we looked at the transaction of homes around the coastal areas in the state and see whether homes that are subject to sea level rise risk are experiencing discount on home prices compared to similar houses but without such risks. So our first study focused on housing transaction on Oahu, and that was largely due to data availability. We didn't have enough observations of home transactions outside Oahu back then for the first study. And then we started working with new data set on home transactions that have much better coverage of home transactions in Neighbor Island. That also allowed us to look at how the home prices changed over time across homes subject to sea level rise risk versus those without. So that way we could make a better apples-to-apples comparison of different homes and try to tease out the pure impacts of sea level rise risk on home prices.
Ultimately, what you found was that properties by coastal regions that are affected by sea level rise are appreciating more slowly than properties that aren't. But you break it down by island, which I thought was really interesting. So could you give a little more detail about what the findings were for each of the Hawaiian islands that you looked at?
So it's very interesting you raised that point, right? Because the real estate markets within the islands are somewhat different, right? Oahu obviously being more urbanized, right, as opposed to perhaps Big Island. So one thing that clearly stands out is the presence of non-local buyers is different across different islands, right? And Maui and Kauai tend to have higher number of non-locals. So that's one sort of motivation for looking at different angles of different islands, sorry. And what we actually find is that sea level rise appreciation penalty is more pronounced in Oahu and Big Island and less pronounced in Maui. And I believe we found no statistical significance for Kauai. And actually, if you look at the Maui and Kauai market, they tend to have a higher non-local presence. So the idea here is that first of all, local buyers in Hawaii are more attuned to sea level rise risk. And if you look at things such as surveys, climate surveys, Yale climate surveys, people in Hawaii tend to be bigger believers of climate change. So we believe this is the role of belief. And actually, I think one of the really interesting findings of our paper is that on average, local buyers discount properties exposed to sea level rise much higher than non-local buyers. And the reason that we may not have results for Kauai is because there's a high presence of non-local buyers in that coastal segment. And for Maui, it's obviously lower. It's still significant, but it's a lower penalty. But then again, coastal real estate segment of Maui also has higher number of non-local buyers.
Nori, how did these results differ from your previous paper that just looked at Oahu? And were you surprised when you saw some of these relationships between things like local versus non-local buyers, or even the fact that just 1 foot of sea level rise corresponded to some of this depreciation.
So when it comes to our new findings about local versus non-local buyers, it was somewhat surprising because some of the earlier studies using mainland, like US mainland data, find a somewhat different result in that what they find using the 48 contiguous states data is that the sea level rise discount tends to be bigger if the buyers are more experienced, like investor type, as opposed to like local. So it seems that the finding is different when it comes to Hawaii, where possibly local buyers care more about the risk of sea level rise because that's where they stay and live, as opposed to those people who purchase homes for like investment purposes. They may have like shorter time horizon. They may be thinking about like selling their homes again in the near future. And that could explain the difference.
What do you feel like someone who is thinking about buying a home or is trying to buy a home should know about all this research?
Yes, sure. So I think our findings indicate that the risk of future sea level rise already affects current housing market. So it seems that home buyers already factor in those risks. But perhaps, I mean, as Talal's explanation indicated, the extent to which such risk is incorporated is very incomplete. It doesn't seem that home buyers can accurately reflect the scientific risk of sea level rise in a full extent. And that could be largely because some of those risk factors are not salient to home buyers. Not everyone can immediately see how risky their coastal homes are. Actually, just this morning, there was a newspaper article about Zillow, which says that Zillow actually started publishing coastal risk factors in their like home listing. They decided to take it away because, I mean, some of the home buyers and real estate companies complained. And one of the takeaway from, I think, our research is that it is always a good idea for a home buyers to have access to like accurate information about coastal risks of their homes. What we would recommend to home buyers would be to do due diligence and carefully research what kind of risk there are with the house that you're looking at, how likely is the flooding, and whether your home is in a flood zone or subject to sea level rise risk. That's something that every home buyer should be mindful of.
Talal, anything to add on things home buyers or potential home buyers should know and how to best equip themselves with knowledge given the research?
I think regulation really plays an important role here. So for example, I'm going to once again talk a little bit about the paper. This wasn't in the main text. This was more in like the supplementary information. But throughout the main text, we're just looking at like the average appreciation penalty, right? In the supplementary information, we try and instead of the average, we let it dynamically evolve over time instead of just looking like an average between our sample period, right? We let it vary for each year. And if you do that, you sort of see like this interesting inflection point around 2017, which coincides with, I believe, King Tides events in Hawaii, which had some sort of like extensive media coverage, as well as the first sea level rise statewide vulnerability assessment report in 2017. So this really speaks to the power of information and sort of like regulation. The other things that I believe homeowners should be concerned by or concerned with is insurance, right? The cost of flood insurance, right? I think Dr. Nori might have some interesting perspectives on that.
I think another takeaway message is, so when it comes to the risk of sea level rise, it seems that high-rise condos are not necessarily like safer investment. Because you might think that if you live on the, let's say, like 10th floor of a condominium building, you might be safe, protected by sea level rise. But our finding indicates that's not necessarily the case because the home price appreciation discount seems to apply to like those multifamily condo units too. And the rising like insurance premium, especially for those high-rise condos, that might be like making the matter worse, really, yeah.
Those were UH researchers Nori Tarui and Talal Khan. Today we're talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to the new study on our website after the show. Now it's time for us to dig up the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier we asked which of the flowers that represent the Hawaiian Islands is the only non-native flower. The blossom in question, the lokelani or the pink rose, is the first part of today's answer. The lokelani is a native of Asia, which was brought to the New World by the Spanish and introduced to Hawaii in the 1800s. It's known for its pleasing fragrance, and many speculate that's why it was chosen over the iconic Haleakala silver sword to represent Maui, which is the second part of our answer. Today, oil from the lokelani is used in popular beauty and wellness products that help hydrate and tone the skin. The sweet fragrance is thought to have a calming effect and is used in aromatherapy to reduce stress and anxiety. If you'd like to catch a glimpse of the lokelani and perhaps a whiff, Maui's Kula Botanical Garden and the Garden of Eden Arboretum in Haikou are two great spots to visit. And we had lots of interest in this backyard quiz. And our winner today, Kanoi from Nu'uanu, she's a kumuhula who says she teaches her students about island flowers all the time. Congrats to you. And that's our quiz. If you have an idea, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii Public Radio brings the community together through our multi-platform Live from the Atherton event series. From jazz to classical, Hawaii Public Radio showcases local musicians in an intimate studio setting. We also welcome authors to host readings and discussions about their work.
This is a story, a mo'olelo. It's not really my story, but it involves me. Sometimes as a subject, sometimes as an unwitting object, sometimes as an unwilling participant. A mo'olelo that does not involve the teller is almost worthless. Just about as worthless as a story that is only about the teller.
Can't join us in person? Watch previous performances online on hawaiipublicradio.org/watch.
A global real estate giant will buy Alexander & Baldwin and take it private in a deal that's expected to close early next year. Buyers include the investment giant Blackstone Real Estate. A&B is one of the largest private landowners in Hawaii, and its portfolio includes 21 retail centers and 14 industrial properties. Blackstone currently owns several luxury hotels in the state, as well as the Pearl Ridge Center on Oahu. Today, we wanted to take a look back at the history of the Big Five as we consider what comes next for Alexander & Baldwin. Carol McLennan is a professor emerita at Michigan Tech University. She's also the author of the book Sovereign Sugar, Industry and Environment in Hawaii. She spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the history of the Big Five from the missionary era to the present day.
I traveled to Hawaii in the early 70s, and I was acutely aware of the crisis that the state was undergoing at the time as major sugar plantations started to close. And so beginning in the 1970s, I studied the plantation closings, which were at Kohala, Kahuku, and I think a plantation on Kauai. They just announced we're shutting down, and it was the beginning of the complete closure of the sugar and eventually pineapple production in Hawaii and opening up all these lands. And they had so dramatically changed the lands and the demography, you know, the peopling of Hawaii, you know, their footprint was just huge. And so after doing that research on the plantation closings, which lasted until the early 1990s, by then the only plantation that was left was Alexander and Baldwin. And they were on Maui. It was the big plantation that was part of the, you know, central part of Maui. And so they hung on for a while producing sugar for local markets and so on, but it wasn't their major business by any means, Alexander and Baldwin. So I wanted to understand how they had accrued the kind of power that they did, ownership over land, water resources, the power until 1960 to really influence public policy in Hawaii, resource policy. So I just wanted to untangle that and go back to the beginning of sort of the American appearance in Hawaii through the missionary effort.
Let's go back to that beginning and the origin of the companies that would become the Big Five. Alexander and Baldwin in particular, it's kind of a relative latecomer. I believe it was the last of the Big Five to really form. But the founders of these companies, what were they trying to do when they moved out to Hawaii and started what would become these sugar plantations?
So it starts with the missionaries who come to Hawaii in the 1820s and throughout the, until about the 1830s. And then they built all of the missions and they get very involved in the government. And they are very influential with King Kamehameha III. And they have influenced the development of the Constitution, the privatization of property, i.e. the land is no longer held by chiefs or kings, and the sense of common land rights disappear, and you have the privatization of property, and then land sales and water sales, and it goes from there. So the Big Five come out of that in interesting ways. They're, first of all, the Alexanders, Cooks, Baldwins, and then the Rices and Wilcoxes, they're second generation intermarry. So that's important. So you've got these cross family alliances and these property interests that become part of this second generation. They're all intermarried. And then even in the third generation, you see some intermarriage. Then that ceases as time goes on. But this cements a really strong, committed, like-minded group of people who accrue the property. And the result of that is that they start forming, they build these small plantations, but they begin to industrialize and they begin to develop them by developing capital, expanding their interest to include all of the infrastructure that's necessary to supply the plantations, so the railroads, eventually a telephone company, electric company, the merchandising that's needed to bring in equipment and supplies and so on. So they began to branch out, and many family members own these subsidiary companies. They're accumulating land and they're beginning to industrialize sugar production so that it becomes one of the most highly industrialized, mechanized plantation systems by, say, the 1940s in the world. And they have a huge labor force, which they're bringing in from all over. So all of this development of sugar interests, starting with the missionaries and then becoming these large corporations, which then become the Big Five, they are consolidating their power, changing the landscape and the sort of composition of the population as well. And most people were in the sugar industry as sugar workers, or pineapple workers, or work for the subsidiary companies that supplied these industries. So they dominated the workforce and they dominated the capital and the land in the islands. And by 1930, they were kind of at their apex. And then from there, there was a decline, particularly with World War II and militarization of the Hawaiian islands.
It seems like two of the big themes here are consolidation of power and reinvention. I guess I wonder how the Big Five prior to, you know, the mid-20th century managed to consolidate all this power while also having to several times think critically about their business model, whether it was really about sugar and whether it was more about land ownership. Or did they know that all along?
Well, land ownership was absolutely crucial. And because these were missionary families, I mean, they weren't wealthy Americans who came here. So they were able to lease a large part of their land from the king, from the kingdom, and on these 50-year leases. And so they didn't have to purchase the land. Their capital went to machinery and to importing labor. So they were very sort of methodical, the owners of these plantations, in cooperating with one another. So from very early on, they built a planter organization beginning in 1850, and it became more and more crucial to their, what you're calling, business model. They needed it to centralize the scientific work that was being done. They needed it to help them develop policies towards labor, negotiate with the labor unions as they began to see strikes occurring, you know, first major strike in 1909 on Oahu. So you see this effort to build this organization outside of the Big Five in order to cooperate with one another. And that was one example of how they accrued power. Another is, you know, land was critical. And so they were able to get these huge leases of land from the king, of crown lands. And they would also buy lands from Hawaiians who did own land. And they built these plantations out from very small to much larger acreages. And they invested heavily in water development. And that was really important because you have to have a continuous water supply to grow sugar. And in order to maintain that, you tend to build your plantations on the windward side of the islands. And so they were doing that, but they wanted this. There was quite a bit of land in the drier areas, and they began to develop irrigation systems. And then after 1900, they began to pump groundwater from Pearl Harbor and Wailuku and Lahaina and around those plantations, and began to supply these dry areas with lots of water. And so this is how they expanded their sort of power and control over the land and the water. And then politically, they had a really important role that they played. They were quite sort of adept at employing all these different means to consolidate power. So it wasn't just building capital. It wasn't just making profits. It was their role as missionaries were important. Their access to the royal family over the generations and ability to act as advisors to the royal family, which they started in their role of missionaries, but continued throughout. So being very influential in developing government policies. So all of this really enabled them, along with their planters organization, to build this powerful machine that we then called the Big Five by 1930.
That was anthropologist Carol McLennan talking with HGR's Maddie Bender. McLennan's book is called Sovereign Sugar. It was published a little over a decade ago. We'll have more from their conversation after a break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
All of us at Hawaii Public Radio are so grateful for the many individuals, families, local businesses, community partners, and foundations that demonstrate so many ways to be generous. Mahalo. Your support enables trusted local news and music that is 100% independent. Support from first-time givers will keep HPR strong and moving forward together. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects and planners for the Honoʻuluʻuli Middle School in East Kapolei, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Let's return to our discussion with anthropologist and author Carol McLennan. Her book details the rise of the Big Five in the sugar economy in Hawaii and how this history still impacts us today. McLennan picks up with a brief history of Alexander and Baldwin.
Well, A&B is an interesting entity as part of the Big Five, they tended to be a little bit smaller. For the longest time, they were dominated by the Alexander and Baldwin families, whereas the other companies diversified so heavily that they had all kinds of stockholders, and the sort of the family ownership began to disappear in the 1950s and 60s. But Alexander and Baldwin kind of stayed intact. They were also, almost all of Alexander and Baldwin's interests were on Maui, whereas the other companies had interests on all the islands. And the Alexander and Baldwin families and their descendants continued to live on Maui. They never became a multinational company like in the 1960s and 70s, like the others did, where you had all this capital coming in from the mainland. So they were kind of unique, and they had a reputation in the, you know, from 1900 on of being kind of like the captains of the island. They invested, they had huge ranches. They owned the pineapple plantations. They ended up with pretty much almost all of the sugar plantations. The one near Lahaina, for instance, was Pioneer Sugar. That was a Hackfeld plantation, but Alexander and Baldwin acquired the assets after World War I. And so they just, they controlled a lot of the small sort of business operations there in a way that none of the other Big Five did. They were unique. They also built the only sugar museum. So there's a museum in close to Wailuku that talks about the sugar industry on Maui. And they continued to grow cane and harvest it and burn cane and so on until fairly recently when they shut it down. So they maintained the sugar legacy and the local legacy much longer than the other companies did. So the fact that they are part of a merger and then they're going private is a pretty significant ending to that historical lineage that all those companies participated in. But A and B, for the longest time, was very distinct in that way.
It stood alone as kind of one of the last remnants of the Big Five that you can trace back to the beginning with the missionaries.
Definitely.
It's interesting now, too, in light of pivoting from sugar to pineapple to macadamia nuts and coffee and consolidating political power at the same time, that you can look at A and B's more recent history with a little bit of that mindset, getting back to the question of, did they think of it as reinventing their business or did they think of it as simply adapting with the times?
I think they were much more self-conscious of being committed locally. The other corporations lost that as they diversified and other interests came in, and they all became land developers. They took their sugar and pineapple out of production. They had these moonscape landscapes that were just, you know, deprived of the original ecosystem. Still, they developed that. They used their water sources to develop that as well and build a, you know, an incoming water supply for new residents. And, you know, you see that on Oahu and Maui in particular, you know, heavy development like that. And A&B was part of that, but they had a reputation for a very long time as being committed locally to Hawaii and not being outsiders who were coming in and exploiting, and committed to sugar too. So they had, I think there was a kind of nostalgia about A and B for a long time because they distinguished themselves in that way. So that was very purposeful, I think. I'm really surprised at this new development and I need to look into it to learn more about. I didn't see it coming. I thought this was just, they were just going to peter out of agriculture, but they were going to continue with development and local Maui commitments.
Is there anything about the history that could inform what could come next?
The recent history is instructive. All of the companies, other companies, were essentially bought out either over a longer period of time or, you know, in big blocks beginning in the 1960s. The Davies Company was bought out by Jardine, which was a British-owned Hong Kong company, and then eventually, you know, sort of disappeared from Hawaii. And their land and water became, you know, of concern to the people who lived in those communities. A lot of it was the Hamakua Coast on the Big Island. C. Brewer was bought out by a Pennsylvania company, Castle and Cook by San Francisco-based company, and even the headquarters of these large companies left Honolulu and went elsewhere. So, you know, Hawaii was just like a subsidiary of these companies, and there was no local commitment. It took some time for that to happen, but from the 1970s into the 1990s, you could really see that happen. So that's very instructive. When you have a buyout from, you know, elsewhere, you have an absentee landlord. It's one thing if they just, you know, have a lot of capital invested in businesses, but it's another thing when they're invested in the land. That's significant for people in Hawaii because it really affects life there, how land is used, how these companies manage their land, the extent to which they get benefits from the government for developing land and utilizing resources. You know, that's a tale that's worth looking into. What happened to the other companies of the Big Five? How did that affect people in Hawaii? And I think it made Hawaii much more dependent on tourism and people coming and settling there from the mainland and on the military. And all of a sudden, the whole character of the islands has shifted. And people have looked very nostalgically at the sugar. As exploitative as it was of land and people, there's a nostalgia for it because it was a local thing.
Yeah, yeah. And these big moves and shifts in industry, I think, does make a little more sense when you put it in terms of there being an economic vacuum and having to fill it, having the military come in during World War II and never really leave. What do you think you'll be following, or what kinds of questions do you think you'll have about A and B?
I'm going to be really curious as to how this Blackstone investment firm views its commitment to place and to people. I mean, that's a different animal than the companies that bought out the other Big Five. They were multinational companies with interests in all kinds of industrial as well as retail activities and land development. How is Blackstone going to look at their assets in Hawaii? How is it going to deal with the people who make up Alexander and Baldwin still today? You know, the people who work for it, who manage the resources. And they say they're going to be committed to having a local perspective, but they all have said that. And nobody can hold them to it legally or any other way. I'm going to be watching that really closely because I think that we used a phrase many years ago when we talked about pineapple in Hawaii, and we talked about the auto industry, and it was called the runaway shop. Have you ever heard that? It was a common way of talking about industries who close their factories and go somewhere else where there's cheaper labor and cheaper costs. So in the automotive industry, we were outsourcing to Mexico and other places, the building of engines, closing factories in the U.S., the rubber plants were moving from Ohio for tires, but the rubber production was moving from Ohio to the South where labor was cheaper. Pineapple left Hawaii pretty quickly and moved to partly to the Philippines, but also Dole, part of Castle and Cook, to Central America. So they closed plantations where they paid good wages and benefits and supported communities and opened up in other places where they could make, you know, pay less in terms of wages in particular. And we called that the runaway shop. And there was no way for local governments to protect themselves from that. All of a sudden, the whole economy collapses. And if you can think about the plantations like Kohala or Kahuku in the less populated areas of the Big Island and Oahu, you know, those communities just collapsed because there was no new industrial or large employer business to move in.
Is there anything else you would like to add? Any final thoughts for our listeners?
I think it's really important to look at the consolidation of power through all kinds of political, economic, and cultural means over time, and see how it changes the way people live, and also it changes the land and all of the really important assets, water and forests and, you know, the whole landscape of communities and places. It's really important to understand that because it does repeat in new forms, but it does repeat, and you learn a lot by focusing in on that history.
Thank you for the history lesson, Carol McLennan. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Maddie. That was actually a lot of fun.
That was Carol McLennan, author of the 2014 book Sovereign Sugar. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. Got questions about the A and B merger? Concerns? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to have more on the crackdown on illegal fireworks. What are your thoughts about that tragedy that took place almost a year to the day? Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 and record your comments or reach out by email or social media. You can find the conversation as a podcast. Head to Spotify or Apple or check out our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.